Good morning and welcome to Sun Sounds of Tucson, Arizona. Today's date is the 13th of August, 2026. My name is Alan Jones and I will be reading the news today from the Arizona Daily Star. The headlines for today: Trump swap made in-flight riskier, church immunity ruling challenged, hunting in Arizona drives decline in cougar numbers, and Head Start rules see pushback. Our first story: Trump swap made his flight riskier. Attribution to Bo Erickson of Reuters. U.S. President Donald Trump said on Wednesday he secretly switched planes in Turkey last month at the direction of the U.S. Secret Service, but that the plane he ultimately flew on was still more vulnerable than Air Force One. Following a NATO summit in Ankara, Trump was transferred from Air Force One to a military plane via a catering truck in an extraordinary deception prompted by an Iranian assassination threat, U.S. media reported. The White House did not disclose the change, and it remained a secret until Washington Post first reported it on Monday. Some media commentators questioned whether the operation left Trump's aides and journalists traveling with him at risk aboard the plane presumed to be carrying the president. "I think actually the plane that I flew on was at greater risk," Trump said to reporters on Tuesday. "I think it was at a greater risk because that would be the plane I think they would be more likely to go for." Trump was accompanied by several close aides when he secretly transferred from Air Force One to a smaller military aircraft in Turkey last month, the Washington Post reported on Wednesday. White House Deputy Chief of Staff Dan Scavino, Executive Assistant Natalie Harp, and Oval Office Operations Director Walt Neuter made the move in the catering truck with Trump, along with several lower-profile aides, the Post reported. No cabinet officials joined Trump in the truck, according to the newspaper. After a day of social media memes portraying Trump as hiding out in the catering truck, the image-conscious president, who often promotes memes of himself as a bold and courageous leader, said he was following the direction of the Secret Service, the agency that protects the president. "Well, it's only up to the Secret Service. I just follow what they like to do, so I go by Secret Service and military," Trump said. "I guess there was a threat out there. I didn't really ask too much about it. I get a lot of threats," Trump said. A White House said at the time that the president was flying aboard Air Force One from Turkey to Britain, but moments after Trump boarded the plane, he left it in a secret via catering truck and boarded another aircraft for the flight to Britain. The Post said on Monday, quoting unnamed sources, Trump had taken a newly renovated Qatari-donated aircraft to Ankara for the NATO summit, but unexpectedly announced he would use an older Air Force One when departing the country, a move that prompted questions about the newer plane's security. The trip to NATO was the first international travel for the new plane, whose speedy upgrades triggered questions over its cost and security and took place as hostilities escalated with Iran, which borders Turkey. Our next story: Church immunity ruling challenged. Attribution to Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. The attorneys for two girls molested for years by their father are making a last-ditch effort to convince the Arizona Supreme Court it was wrong in holding the Mormon Church immune from liability over what its bishops and others knew. Lynn Cadigan said she and co-counsel John Tribone are not arguing that clerics have to disclose everything they hear in confession. That is clearly a protection under Arizona law. But Cadigan said the justices got it wrong when they concluded that each religion gets to decide not only when its clergy can ignore laws that require everyone else in Arizona to report ongoing child abuse, but also to define for themselves, free from oversight by Arizona courts, what is considered a protected confidential communication, even when multiple people have heard it. I don't understand why the Supreme Court ignored the clear intent of the legislation trying to protect children who are voiceless, Cadogan told Capital Media Services. The purpose of the statute is to give voice to children who have no way of protecting themselves, she said. Instead, they decided to place their emphasis on protecting the perpetrators' souls and ignore the needs of these abused children. Potentially more significant, Cadogan said, Trebon are telling the justices that letting their decision stand creates a dangerous precedent, allowing each religion to interpret what and when they have to report and what the law requires. The court has essentially established an absolute immunity for religious institutions that fail to report child sexual abuse, insulating them from civil liability and judicial oversight even when an abuser reveals his crimes in the presence of multiple people over a period of years and were never confidential, they wrote. They said that turns legislative public policy on its head. The odds are against the lawyers getting the court to reverse its July 10 ruling, giving immunity to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The case was decided on a 7-0 vote. But Cadogan and Trebon said they want to point out to the court what they are saying are mistakes in both fact and law that the justices made in the 23-page ruling in hopes they will reconsider. The case involves Paul Adams, a Bisbee man who confessed to his LDS bishop in 2011 that he was sexually abusing one of his daughters. That confession was repeated to his wife, Lisa, to another bishop, and eventually to multiple church members as part of an excommunication. But there was no reporting to authorities. Adams later went on to also sexually molest a second daughter, an infant, and even posted videos online of the abuse. Those videos eventually led to his arrest, but not until 2017. He died by suicide while awaiting trial. Cadogan, representing the children, sued the church and the bishops for failing to follow state laws that require reporting of sexual abuse if it is learned outside the context of a confession or confidential communication with a clerk. The LDS Church, however, argued that everything Adam said to anyone fits within what the church considers a confidential communication with a cleric. The justice ruled unanimously that the church and the church alone gets to decide what is a confidential communication that can remain secret no matter what. No civil court can second-guess the High Court ruled. In their new filing on Wednesday, the attorney said the justices ignored certain facts. One was that the bishop, John Herod, had Adams confessed to his wife and bishop, told Lisa to report the confession to police to protect her children. Obviously, Paul Adams could not have considered the meeting to be confidential, neither did Lisa, the new filing states. On top of that, the lawyer said, there were at least 35 people who learned of the ongoing molestation through the church disciplinary proceedings. Cadogan said that clearly wasn't the kind of a confidential communication the law is designed to protect. She said that would be the equivalent of any religion deciding that someone could scream out your confession to the world and that it fits within the religion's definition of confession. That's not confidential, she said. As much as she said she disagreed with, Cadogan said, they are not challenging the authority of the legislature to exempt clergy from having to discuss what they hear as part of a confession. But in asking the justices to reconsider, she and Trebon want the High Court to make some determination of what is considered confidential communication and not simply leave it to each religion to decide that question. And, as the court here ruled, have its decisions immunized from court scrutiny. the lawyers called the court's conclusion novel and unsupported by legal precedent. Even in states where the clergy hold the privilege, secular courts determine if communications are truly confidential, they said. They said that means if the clergy claims the privilege allowed under Arizona law from having to report what is learned in what the church considers confession, civil courts are required to consider on a religious neutral basis whether it truly fits the exemption from disclosure in the court as a confidential communication. That, they said, has to be done using the traditional objective standard focusing on the circumstances of communication, not what the church says it is. The church should not decide the parameters of a state statute using its own doctrine to support statutory elements, they wrote. To decide otherwise and to let the decision stand creates a dangerous precedent, Cadogan and Treborn said. If an abuser can reveal his crimes to multiple people over a period of years, as occurred here, yet the institution remains immunized from civil liability, based entirely on its own subjective doctrinal determinations, the fundamental right of vulnerable citizens to access the courts for redress is defeated, the lawyers told the court. They also said this isn't a question of civil courts staying out of essentially religious controversies that have no effect on others. Instead, the lawyers told the justices that what they decided allows churches to displace judicial interpretation of a neutral state statute. The filing means the justices must now decide whether to revisit their ruling. Our next story. Hunting in Arizona drives decline in cougar numbers. Attribution to Henry Breen of the Arizona Daily Star. Arizona's population of mountain lions is headed for a crash, and state-regulated hunting is to blame, according to a new lawsuit from conservationists. The Center for Biological Diversity is suing the Arizona Game and Fish Department and its rulemaking commission to stop the state's annual mountain lion hunt until such time as self-sustaining reproduction and population's recovery have been established and verified. The center points to the state's own harvest data as proof that cougar hunting is unsustainable in Arizona because too many females and young lions are being killed before they can replenish the population. The Tucson-based environmental group and its co-founder Robin Silver filed suit in Maricopa County Supreme Court on Friday. Arizona state sanctioned killing of kittens and juvenile mountain lions is barbaric, unsustainable, and illegal, said Silver in a written statement. State law requires the Game and Fish Commission and department to put science and public trust first rather than the whims of the mountain lion sport hunters and ranchers. It's time to end this slaughter and ensure that mountain lions will continue to roam the wilds of Arizona into the future. Silver and company cite publicly available statistics from AZGFD showing that of the 1,937 mountain lions killed by hunters from 2018 to 2024 is 41% were females and 54% were under 2 years old, not yet reproductive age. A lawsuit points to the research suggesting that killing more than 20% of adult females in a hunting population can sharply reduce cougar numbers. Modeling analysis by three different wildlife demographic experts, each independently, concluded that current levels of hunting losses will lead to steep declines in the state's cougar population, the lawsuit states. One analysis predicts an 80% drop in mountain lion numbers over the next 12 years, while another shows the functional extirpation of the species from across much of Arizona in about 15 years without an influx of lions from neighboring states. Game and Fish spokesman Michael Colonani, said the department cannot comment on pending litigation. On its website, AZGFD notes that mountain lions are considered a species of least concern across North America and are not listed as threatened or endangered in Arizona. Monitoring and modeling suggest the population is stable to increasing, with animals widely distributed and expanding their range into the southwest region of the state where they were once only transient, the website states. The Center for Biological Diversity, Unorthodox Legal Filings, features charts, graphs, and even a photo Silver took of a mountain lion in Arizona. There are also sworn declarations from several cougar experts, including Ron Thompson, a former state lion biologist for Game and Fish, who said he agrees with the conclusion reached by the demographic analysis commissioned by the center. Under the current AZGFD mountain lion sport hunting strategy, the mountain lion population in the state of Arizona will be unsustainable, non-functional, and non-viable in the near future. Thompson says this is his declaration. He goes on to argue that cougar numbers are unlikely to be boosted by immigration in the future, as lions are increasingly prevented from moving into Arizona by overhunting in neighboring states and man-made barriers such as highways, rail lines, fenced aqueducts, and, in the case of Mexico, the expanding border wall. Hunting the cats in Arizona requires a valid hunting license and a mountain lion tag, with a bag limit of one animal per hunter in a calendar year. It's illegal to kill a female with kittens or kittens young enough to still have their spots. The Arizona Game and Fish Commission has divided the state into 15 regional zones, each with its own unique harvest threshold that triggers the close of the season once the number has been met there. The zone that includes Tucson, for example, has a harvest limit of 46 lions. This season, across an area stretching from the eastern boundaries at the Tohono O'odham Nation to the New Mexico border and from Interstate 10 north to the San Carlos Apache Indian Reservation. Hunters are required to report any mountain lion they take within 48 hours and present the carcass within 10 days for physical inspection by a state game officer who will collect the age, sex, and other biological data. AZGFD uses that harvest information to estimate the total number of cougars in the state. According to the department's website, Arizona's average of 2,876 animals from 2004 through 2020, with no indication of population decline. Cougar hunting season is slated to start on August the 21st and last through May the 31st across Arizona, excluding tribal lands. The statewide mountain lion quota for the upcoming season is 338. Our next story. Head Start rules see pushback. Attribution to Zachary Shmerl of the USA Today. The Trump administration's drastic deregulation of Head Start, a preschool and child care program that helped tens of millions of low-income kids, is generating bipartisan pushback in Congress. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy announced August the 5th that his agency is pursuing a sweeping rollback of much of the more than 100 pages of federal rules governing the multi-billion dollar program. Among the items on the chopping block are requirements to conduct screening for kids with disabilities, keep class sizes small, help children brush their teeth daily, and mandate and monitors on school buses. Pay parity rules for staff and a ban on expelling students would go by the wayside, too. Senate Republicans have expressed wariness in recent days about the prospect of slashing those standards, which advocates say help keep kids safe and healthy. We've been hearing from our Head Start folks back home that are concerned about what they are seeing, Senator Lisa Murkowski
Republican from Alaska told USA Today that's something that we're monitoring. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina, said he explored reforms to Head Start at the state level when he was a speaker of his state's legislature years ago, but he appeared skeptical of the merits of a deregulation that's too broad. Just walking away and turning a blind eye toward it, I don't think that's a good idea, he told USA Today. The worries in the GOP are significant, especially given that meaningful pushback on Capitol Hill, particularly from key Republicans in the Senate, can become one of the most effective forms of resistance to Trump's administration policies. Similar objections among people like Senator Susan Collins, a Maine Republican and a powerful chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, to completely eliminate Head Start were arguably what ultimately saved it last year. Senator Jim Justice, Republican from West Virginia, cautioned that though he supports making improvements to the program, it's already helping a lot of kids who benefit phenomenally. When we start tweaking with the stuff, a lot of time we can make it better, he said in a brief interview. But there are ways we can make it worse too. In Kennedy's eyes, the new effort will streamline Head Start, which serves hundreds of thousands of low-income families annually, and cut red tape, all while expanding the number of enrolled kids. Alex Adams, one of Kennedy's deputies who runs an HHS division, called the Administration for Children and Families, stressed on a recent call with reporters that Head Start providers will still be subject to state and local regulations. Just because they'll have fewer federal rules to follow doesn't mean they should ignore what works for them, he said. Flexibility is permission. It's not a mandate, he said. Democrats bristled at that notion. They're saying they might be able to serve more children by promising each child less, Senator Patty Murray, Democrat from Washington, said. President Trump has all but declared war on Head Start. Senator Bill Cassidy, the chairman of the Senate Health and Education Committee, which has jurisdiction over Head Start, said he's been talking with his staff about the major proposed regulatory changes. In the thick of a political fight to confirm Todd Blanche as Attorney General, he said August the 6th he hadn't fully delved into them yet. I'd like to see what they're actually put out, he told USA Today. The 75-page proposed rule officially published on August the 7th in the Federal Register isn't all deregulation. It includes new rules, too. English would become the main language of instruction, and kids with a different first language would need to learn it while enrolled. There are also freshly dietary guidelines and an exercise directive, 30 minutes of physical activity for every 3.5 hours of classroom instruction. The regulatory process is still in its early stages, though, and the proposal may get tied up in court. Carrie Garvin, who ran the office of Head Start in the Biden administration, stressed that there will be a 60-day public comment period. His message to any concerned families or teachers, there still is an opportunity for their voices to be heard. No one should surrender and feel like, well, all is done, he said. We will now move on to the Tucson and region news. Our first story. Get a sneak peek at Tucson's newest casino. The Pascua-Yaki Third Casino is set to open on West Side on November the 15th. Attribution to Catalina E. Birch of Arizona Daily Star. The countdown timer in Casino del Sol's temporary office on West Grant Road was ticking down the days and hours, 91 days, 17 hours, as of late Tuesday morning, to the November 15th grand opening at Vahi Tam, the Pascua-Yaki new casino sitting just outside of downtown Tucson. As construction workers busied about the still-unfinished 154,480 square foot casino on Tuesday morning. The casino CEO and general manager led a sneak preview tour for nearly a dozen reporters. "They're moving so fast," Casino de Sol's interim CEO, Amanda Sampleson Lumavesa, said, surveying workers installing a platform in front of a giant video wall that will greet visitors near the main entrance. "Every time I come here, it's a leap forward. This is the Pascua Yaqui's third casino, and it comes 25 years after it opened Casino del Sol on West Valencia Road in 2001. Its flagship casino of the Sun at 7406 South Camino del Oeste started as a bingo club in 1982 and opened as a full-fledged casino in 1994. "It's exciting," GM Lisa Sesma said, of the casino's location near downtown. "I was scared at first because I wasn't sure how people would react, but it's been so good." The opening comes nearly 2 years after the tribe broke ground on a 31-acre parcel on West Grant Road near Interstate 10 that had been home to several businesses and the Century 16 multiplex. Sesma said, when fully built out in the next couple of years, the project could include a hotel and convention center, although plans are still undecided. But Sesma said the casino at 1055 West Grant Road would spark development and change along West Grant Road, reviving an area that has seen an exodus of businesses largely due to recent road construction. Sesma said the casino could draw visitors from as far away as Texas, as well as from Casa Grande, Phoenix, and Mexico. When Vahatahim pronounced Van Hietahim opens, it will include 52,252 square foot gaming floor with 928 slot machines and 24 table games, 5 bars and lounges, Sol sports books that allows wagers on perhaps teasers, futures, players, prompts, in-play and round robins. Dining options include OP Grill, an upscale casual dining restaurant on the mezzanine overlooking the gaming floor with a menu that focuses on local flavors, a trio of fast casual eateries, Asian fusion, streetscape pizza, and deli and Adulitas Taqueria, Mexican food, in the Siwa Market food court. A 1,562 parking spaces, 1,004 of them located in the four-level parking garage. Guests entering through the garage can take the escalators into the casino. Our next story. Judge is wrong to call ESA's vouchers on ballots. Attribution to Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Democratic Secretary of State Adrian Fontes acted illegally in using the word vouchers to describe the program that gives tax dollars to parents to send their children to private and parochial schools, a judge has ruled. Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Julie Ann Mata acknowledged Fontes' arguments that, in preparing a legal description of the effects of voter approval of Proposition 212, he was using the term vouchers because that has been the common understanding of the empowerment of the school scholarship account program. Fontes also noted that the term appears in Black Law's dictionary as representing public funds that may be used to pay tuition at private schools or for home schooling. But Mata pointed out that the word voucher does not appear in an Arizona law governing ESAs. She also noted that the Arizona Supreme Court, more than a decade ago, drew a legal distinction between what it considers to be vouchers, which the High Court said are unconstitutional, and the system that replaced them. That makes the use of the word misleading when telling voters that Prop 212 would mean, Mata said, she has ordered Fontes to reword it. There was no immediate comment from Fontes on whether he will appeal. Arizona law requires the Secretary of State to prepare a brief description of every measure that goes to the voters, as well as an explanation of the effect of it, a yes or no vote. Both of those go directly to the ballots that either are mailed to the individuals or received at the polling stations. Under the category of what approvals of Proposition 212 would mean, Fontes said it would mean amend Arizona's Empowerment Scholarship, ESA, school voucher program, listing various changes the initiative would make. These changes include placing limits on how the funds can be spent and denying benefits to students whose parents earn more than $150,000 a year. But the Arizona Free Enterprise Club, which has advocated to protect and expand the program, said the ESA program is definitely not a voucher program, and Mata agreed. Arizona lawmakers first set up what they acknowledged was a voucher program in 2006, but it was voided 3 years later by the Arizona Supreme Court, with the justices saying it ran afoul of provisions in the Arizona Constitution that ban appropriating public funds in aid to private and parochial schools. In 2011, however, lawmakers came up with empowerment scholarships, a key essential difference in that the state set up a special account that parents can tap to pay tuition and fees for their children at private or parochial schools or for other educational institutions. The State Court of Appeals said these accounts do not amount to tax dollars being used to subsidize private schools. The judges said that's because, technically speaking, it is the parents who decide where the money goes and not the state. That ruling ultimately was upheld by the Arizona Supreme Court in 2014. Since its inception, the new program expanded from one that simply provided funds for students with special needs to later include students in schools rated D or F, foster children, children in military families, and children living on reservations. And in 2022, lawmakers removed all limits that ballooned the program from about 12,000 students to more than 100,000, with the annual cost now surpassing $1 billion. Backers of Proposition 212, including the Arizona Education Association and Save Our Schools, said Proposition 212 will curb the costs of the universal program without affecting students who were considered eligible prior to 2022. Mata's ruling does not deal with the merits of the initiative. Instead, she said, it was wrong for Fontes to use the common, but, she said, legally incorrect term, because the phrase may cause voters to treat legally distinct programs as the same. The court concluded that the use of the school voucher programs is misleading, the judge wrote. All this is occurring against the backdrop of the two other lawsuits over Proposition 212. In another courtroom, supporting ESAs are trying to convince a judge that initiative supporters did not collect 255,949 valid signatures to put the measure on the ballot. They claim many of the more than 400,000 signatures turned in are invalid because many petitions circulators were not legally qualified to collect signatures. Separately, another judge ruled that the Republican-controlled Legislative Council acted improperly in writing what he called a biased explanation of Proposition 212 designed to convince people to vote against the measure. This explanation, unlike the one provided by Fontes, goes into brochures mailed to the homes of all 4.3 million registered voters. Our next story. Governor Hobbs officially picks ex-Republican as a running mate. Attribution to Stacey Marchinger of the Arizona Republic. Governor Katie Hobbs has officially announced former Republican Mayor John Giles as her running mate a week after news of her pick leaked to the national media. Giles, the former mayor of Mesa, was a Republican for decades before he changed his voter registration earlier this year, leaving the GOP to be unaffiliated with any political party. But he has been well established as an anti-Trump conservative who has supported Democrats in recent cycles, including 2024 presidential hopeful Kamala Harris. He was among the most prominent Republicans who supported Hobbs for governor in 2022 over her GOP challenger, Carrie Lake. Hobbs defeated Lake by about 17,000 votes that year. Giles could help Hobbs grow that margin this year by appealing to moderate GOP and independent voters. Giles said in an August 11th statement provided by the campaign that he was honored to join Katie Hobbs on his historic ticket because we share the belief that leadership is about bringing people together and getting results. I'm proud to stand with her to put Arizona first, find common ground, and keep our state moving forward, Giles said. Curiosity about Hobbs's pick to be her lieutenant governor has absorbed political attention across Arizona for about a week, after the New York Times broke the news on August the 4th that Hobbs would name Giles as her running mate. The Times reports relied on two unnamed sources close to the Hobbs campaign and Giles. Still, Hobbs' campaign had refused to confirm the Democrats' choice for her number two, leading to a clunky rollout of her selection. Arizonans will elect a lieutenant governor for the first time this year, after voters created the position by passing a 2022 ballot measure. Representative Andy Biggs, the Republican nominee for governor, who is hoping to keep Hobbs to a single term in office, has previously named his running mate. He selected former state senator and dairy farmer Sine Kerr, a West Valley native who most recently worked for the Trump administration's agricultural department. Biggs' campaign advisor, Drew Sextant, cast Giles as more like Hobbs than someone who would bring in more voters, labeling Giles Kamala Harris' favorite Arizona mayor. Arizonans will see this botched, half-baked announcement as just another example of Katie Hobbs' chaos and incompetence and another reason to vote for Andy Biggs and Sine Kerr in November, Sextant said. Our next story. Arizona's fake electors case dropped, for now. Attribution to Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. The people accused of being fake electors and their allies are officially off the legal hook for now. In a new order, Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Sam Myers granted a motion by Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays to drop the charges of fraud, forgery and conspiracy that were originally filed in 2024 against 11 Republicans who claimed that Donald Trump won the 2020 election and that they were entitled to cast their electoral votes for him despite the fact that official returns showed Joe Biden won Arizona by 10,457 votes. Myers also dismissed the charges against other defendants, including aides and attorneys for Trump, who Mays said were part of a crafting the plan for Arizona and other swing states to throw the electoral count in doubt. That would have denied Biden the necessary 270 electoral votes and left it to Congress to decide who won. But the judge, in his formal order, agreed to the Attorney General's request to make the dismissal without prejudice. That means Mays is free to refile the case if and when she is ready to make another try to get convictions. The order came despite arguments by several defendants who sought to have the case go away permanently. They told Mayers that he should not allow the risk of future prosecutions to remain given the passage of time. The amount of money they have spent, the stress caused to the defendants and what they called fundamental fairness and an interest of justice. Mark Williams, representing former Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani, specifically said that the case brought by the state was frivolous. It was brought to punish Mr. Giuliani and the other defendants for exercising rights, he said. The judge, however, didn't see it that way. While the court does not discount the significance of those circumstances, the court finds that the interests of justice do not require a dismissal and prejudice, Myers wrote in the new order. Our next story. Two people buried in Arizona yard identified as suspects' parents. Attribution to Ray Covarrubias, Jr. of the Arizona Republic. Avondale police identified the two people found buried behind a Litchfield Park home as husband and wife Hector and Larissa Flores. Police officially confirmed their identities Tuesday, August the 11th. The department did not immediately provide additional information about the pair. Police found the bodies after officers conducted on August the 4th welfare check found signs of foul play inside the home near Litchfield and Indian School Road. Investigators later found a large amount of blood inside the home and the two decomposing bodies buried in the backyard, police said. The manner and primary cause of death for both Hector and Larissa Flores were pending, according to the Maricopa County Office of the Medical Examiner. The U.S. Marshals Service is leading an international search for the couple's son, Matthew Christopher Flores Sabanov, after Avondale Police requested federal assistance on August the 7th. Avondale Police identified Flores as a suspect after searching the Flores' home. The agency obtained a federal arrest warrant alleging Flores Semenov fled the country to avoid prosecution. Avondale police are seeking Flores Semenov on suspicion of charges of first-degree murder, domestic violence, and abandonment or concealment of a dead body, the U.S. Marshal said in a wanted notice. Our next story. Parents accused of being intoxicated and walking kids in Arizona heat. Attribution to Elena Santa Cruz of the Arizona Republic. Two parents were arrested after police said that while they were intoxicated, they forced their kids to walk in triple-digit heat. Ryan and Mary Mullen were seen walking their two children around 6 p.m. on August the 9th near 91st and Montebello Avenues in Glendale. The outside temperature at the time was 108 degrees, but the high for Glendale that day was 111, according to a report released by the Glendale police. A woman called police saying the pair appeared to be intoxicated and Ryan was stumbling across the street without the kids and falling over one of them, according to the report. The woman told police that she approached the couple in her vehicle and offered them a ride to avoid the heat, but Ryan became angry and started punching her vehicle, fell and hit his face, according to the report. He had a cut on his face and was bleeding, the report said. Ryan made it clear he did not want her help, the woman told police. She said she wanted him charged with disorderly conduct. The woman alerted police to where Ryan went. An officer approached Ryan holding a young boy's hand in a neighborhood, according to the report, and police body camera footage, and Ryan was extremely slurred in his speech. Ryan was bleeding from his face, the report said, and the officer had to threaten to use force so he would not let go of the boy. When he finally did, the officer had to wrestle with Ryan to get him in handcuffs, the report said. Ryan insulted the officer several times, including saying he was an expletive idiot and struggled to explain how he got hurt, the report said. An officer noted in the report that Ryan emitted a strong alcohol scent. Our next story. Another Arizona officer accused of misusing flock system. Attribution to David Ulloa, Jr. of the Arizona Republic. An officer was placed on administrative leave after investigators found that he may have improperly used an automated license plate reader, according to an August 11th statement released by the Goodyear Police Department. The statement comes a day after an Apache Junction police officer resigned for misusing his department's flock automated license plate reader technology. The Goodyear officer was placed on administrative leave on July the 22nd after investigators at the Goodyear Police Department audited their flock system activity on July the 21st, according to the statement. During their audit, investigators found that there was a potential criminal violation, according to the department's statement. Authorities did not name the officer. The Glendale Police Department was overseeing the criminal investigation. Goodyear Police Department requested an outside law enforcement agency to conduct the criminal investigation. The department will continue its investigation into the potential misuse of its flock system after the Glendale Police Department finishes its investigation. Goodyear Police Department currently operates 33 flock automated license plate reader cameras. There's been a nationwide outcry against automated license plate readers, especially those made by flock. Critics have cited lack of transparency, privacy violations. Immigration authorities requested local partners to conduct searches on its behalf. Tempe dropped participating in Flock's nationwide data sharing program, but it still is using license plate readers. Chandler ceased its contact with the company on August the 7th after the police chief said a Chandler police employee misused flock automated license plate reader data. Our auditing process did exactly what it is intended to do. It identified activity that warranted further review, and we acted immediately, Goodyear Police Chief Brian Izzet said in a written statement. The Goodyear Police Department released information about its automated license plate reader policies, auditing practices, and the ongoing investigation in the interest of transparency, the statement said. We will now move on to the nation and world news. Our first story. Iran, no progress on reviving interim peace deal. Attribution to Parisa Hafezi and Elweli Elweli from Reuters. Iran and the United States remain in loggerheads over efforts to agree a permanent end to the war in the Gulf, according to a senior Iranian source who said there had been no progress in talks to revive the interim deal agreed in June and define a time frame to implement it. The comments were a further blow to hopes of a swift resolution to the crisis following attacks on shipping in the region on Tuesday that pushed oil prices higher. The deal agreed in June declared an immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, but quickly unraveled with U.S. President Donald Trump saying it was over on July the 7th and Iran's foreign ministry declaring it suspended a week later. A U.S. source accuses Iran of failing to honor an agreement under the deal to reopen the vital Straits of Hormuz shipping route. Tehran said Washington has reneged on its commitments, including lifting a blockade of Iranian ports and releasing frozen Iranian assets. One of the issues that is being discussed via mediators is the U.S. returning to the interim agreement and defining a time frame for implementing the commitments. There has been absolutely no progress on this issue, the Iranian source said. There was no immediate comment from Washington. Thousands of people have been killed in the conflict, mainly in Iran and Lebanon, since the U.S. and Israel launched attacks on Iran on February the 28th. Iran has struck U.S. assets and infrastructure in countries including Oman, Jordan, Kuwait, Israel, the United Emirates, and Saudi Arabia. The June interim ceasefire agreement set a 60-day period extended by mutual consent within which Iran and the U.S. were expected to reach a final deal limiting Tehran's nuclear program and lifting U.S. sanctions. The Iranian source dismissed a report on Wednesday from Turkey's Anadolu news agency that quoted Pakistani government sources as saying they had agreed to extend the 60-day period. There is no talk of an extension because, from Iran's perspective, there is no period that began and therefore nothing to extend. The United States violated the interim agreement 48 hours after it was reached and withdrew from it a few days later, the source said. Both Iran and the United States have stepped up rhetoric in the past 2 days. Iran's top security official, Mohsin Rezari, said on Tuesday that the Straits of Hormuz would remain closed unless the U.S. accepted Iran's conditions to end the war. That followed a new demand from Trump on Monday that Iran should pay compensation for people killed in 50 years of wars, attacks, and protests. Throughout the conflict, Trump has alternated between threats of escalation and claims that a peace deal is imminent. Speaking to reporters after a visit to Ohio on Tuesday, Trump said, "Iran is going fine, going just absolutely fine. We have a country that has been the bully of the Middle East for 50 years, really 51 if you think about it, and they are no longer the bully of the Middle East." The Straits of Hormuz, a narrow waterway between Iran and Oman and the entrance to the Persian Gulf, handled a fifth of global oil and liquid natural gas flow before the war. Benchmark crude futures LCOC1 have surged since the start of the war in February, hitting a peak of $126 a barrel, roughly 75% above pre-war levels, with choppy trade reflecting concerns over disruptions to Gulf oil supplies and shifting signals on peace talks. Those concerns were compounded by separate attacks on shipping on Tuesday. At the southern end of the Red Sea, four crew members were killed in an attack by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels on a small cargo ship in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait on Tuesday, the first deadly strike on shipping by the group since the start of the war. The U.S. military, meanwhile, said a U.S. Navy MH-60 helicopter fired two Hellfire missiles to disable the steering gear of a Panama-flagged cargo ship. The ship ignored repeated warnings to stop, violating a naval blockade on Iranian ports, the U.S. Central Command said. Maritime sources told Reuters the vessel was hit off Pakistan while sailing into the Gulf of Oman. Brent futures rose 35 cents, 0.4%, to $89.26 a barrel on Wednesday, heading for a sixth day of gains. Our next story. Ukraine halts tanker strikes at U.S. request. Attribution to Reuters. Ukraine has paused drone strikes on oil tankers using Russian Black Sea port of Novorossiysk after a request from U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance. The Financial Times said on Wednesday, citing Ukrainian officials. The paper said last month's request followed U.S. alarms that Ukraine was destabilizing oil markets and harming U.S. firms by targeting tankers carrying crude piped from Kazakhstan to the Caspian Pipeline Consortium CPC terminal at the port. The Trump administration has warned the Ukrainian government of the need to cease and desist from targeting non-Russian vessels in the Black Sea, as well as CPC infrastructure. A U.S. official told Reuters, adding that the U.S. views the CPC as an alternative to Russian energy supplies. The U.S. has reaffirmed that Ukraine is committed to refraining from targeting CPC infrastructure and non-Russian vessels bound for the CPC offtake point, as long as they are not subjects to Ukrainian sanctions, the officials added. The U.S. State Department and Vance's office said it did not immediately respond to Reuters' request for comments outside of business hours. Reuters could not immediately verify the report. Ukrainian forces recently stepped up strikes on Russian energy infrastructure and other sites in an effort, Kyiv says, aims at depriving Russians of resources to fund its military. Black Sea drone attacks took out as much as a fifth of CPC oil loadings in July, four sources familiar with the data told Reuters last week, as the Russian-Ukraine war spilled over to hit sales by Kazakhstan and Western oil majors. Kazakhstan, which relies on the CPC route for crude exports, suffered a drop of 14% in oil production in early July versus June, the sources said. Chevron and ExxonMobil are among the major Western oil companies operating there. A U.S. official confirmed to the paper that the administration has warned Ukraine to stop attacking non-Russian vessels in the Black Sea. Our next story. Independents back some liberal goals. Attribution to Joseph Axe and Jason Lang of Reuters. Progressive Democratic proposals, including Medicare for All and new taxes on billionaires, powered insurgent candidates, including Abdul al-Sayed, to primary victories this year, shaking the party establishment and leading it to worry about how Democrats will perform in November's midterm elections. But a new Reuters Ipsos poll found those ideas, though by no means all of the progressive agenda, are supported by independent voters who could be decisive in determining whether President Donald Trump's Republican Party maintains its congressional majorities for the next 2 years. About 64% of independent registered voters in the six-day nationwide poll said they support increasing taxes on corporations and billionaires compared to 15% who oppose the idea. And 60% of independents said they support the government providing health care coverage for all Americans, which progressives, including Michigan U.S. Senator nominee al-Sayed, pitched as Medicare for All, expanding the government's run health insurance program to cover all Americans. The results suggest a path forward for candidates like al-Sayed, who will face a Republican Mike Rogers in what is expected to be a highly competitive contest that will play a key role in the deciding Senate control. Michigan, which Trump has won in two of the last three presidential elections, presents a sharper challenge for al-Sayed than those faced by some other high-profile progressives who won primaries in heavily Democratic areas.